to the council.
Okay.
And she got her endorsements. Like, oh, she's real good grassroots. I mean, she's one of the ones that we nominated to run for the post. And then she got, she turned around and got endorsements from us. And look how big that is.
That was a close up.
She got it from the Observer because they had, in 2000 I was a delegate to the National Convention, National Democratic Union.
Oh, okay.
And I found a few of those articles. I wrote articles all week long, and they wanted to know from a delegate perspective what it was like.
Okay.
Even the fun parts, anything.
And yeah.
It was so exciting to jot down notes as I was going along, and I was observing other people. At the end of the day, I go down into the hole, the news hole, as they call it.
Oh, yeah.
And I would write my little article and then email it back to Charlotte.
Oh.
For them to put in the paper the next
day. Oh, that's super.
It was a lot of fun.
Because that's great, too, because that forces you to document and all the stuff you normally maybe wouldn't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So.
This was something. Now this looks like this old Operation 88 that was a statewide. I have probably need to go in order.
Okay.
Because before MVC, I told you I had Mecklenburg Voter Coalition. Before MVC,
yeah,
it was North Carolinians for Effective Citizenship.
Okay. And
CEC, I was a state.
Right.
I was a state director for that.
Oh, and you worked with Randolph Institute.
Philip Randolph has always been a part of our coalition.
Okay.
And at this point, they were just like side by side with us, and there was a lot of, about 15 different organizations in all. Do I have Legal Women Voters on here? See, that's what I'm saying. Still some more that are not on there. And this was Ron Sheridan and I ran the state coordinated campaign. And I was on staff here and here too at the same time.
Okay. So was there a lot of overlapping membership and leadership of some of these organizations?
No, not a lot.
Oh, okay.
Not a lot. And I guess we just need to start from the beginning. And then I'll lay the stuff out and I'll just talk how I got started into it and then come on down the line.
Yeah.
And then pick up stuff as I get to it.
That sounds
maybe
good.
That's the best way.
Yeah,
to handle.
And you have to leave by.
I wanted to be over there at 7, but I don't know if you'll be able to handle it or not. Do you get cards, Christmas cards from?
I don't. I'm not on the list.
This is
that.
This was when I went out to California. So I don't know how.
Oh, Gray Davis.
Gray Davis.
Yeah.
Yeah, he sent that, and I used Clinton. I've got.
Oh, cool. Right.
My sorority. I am now a diamond.
Oh, super.
That brought out the sorority because that's where a lot of my work was initiated.
Were you a member from college onward?
That's where I pledged in college.
Okay.
And I think I told you the reason I pledged. It was not for social reasons or just to become a part of a sisterhood.
Uh-huh.
It was to, so that I could get actual hands-on experience with the day-to-day work world and with community organizations. Delta's very highly involved in
okay.
the community.
Yeah.
Special projects and whatnot. And so, in light of the fact that we did not have internships and practicums, we worked for the students coming behind us to get them, but we did it through our special projects in our sororities.
What college was this that you
North
were?
Carolina Central. And
oh,
that was where my undergraduate
okay.
work was done.
Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it is that picture.
Okay.
That's where they got it from.
Okay.
I don't know if this is the same.
Oh, right there. With
that
the
actually gives
coming.
A little bit of background what I was going to tell you about how I got started.
Oh, good.
First vice at the party for my
Oh, of the Democratic Party, yeah.
This is, last year I was given the Democrat of the Year Award. That's
oh,
what that
super.
Is.
Yeah, one of my, one of the coordinators of the project, she's really interested in knowing more about Jim Pierce and what he was like.
Okay, yeah, I can tell. There I am again. I don't know why this, well, see, this was like, they did stance for all these women leaders.
Oh, yeah.
And the women's associations. And they had me under university associations, and I'm not sure what that plug was. But I was doing more political and community work at that time, but I had university ties too.
Okay.
So that was one.
Yeah.
This is what we used to give out to my volunteers. Jim Pierce came
nice.
Along in 1996.
Yeah.
And this was a pamphlet that we put out. Mecklenburg Voter Registration Committee, because that was the primary thing, was registration.
Okay.
And there were no guides at that time.
Yeah.
The League of Women Voters finally helped the Board of Elections to get a brochure, but we use things like this step-by-step showing people how to vote, the mechanics of voting.
Mm-hmm. The Voter Registration Committee, was that an organization that you started, or was there an
that was
existing
it. It was,
one?
It was the, it, we started it.
Okay.
There was a group called Vote Task Force here in Mecklenburg County.
Okay.
And they only did voter registration.
Okay.
When we came along, we broadened it to a 5-point voter participation program.
Because you said you had accountability was part
of
that.
We had voter registration, voter education, which was the mechanics.
Yeah.
Issue education, get out the vote, and accountability.
How did you do the accountability part?
Okay. League of Women Voters was a part of our group, and they would do the forums, neighborhood forums as well as TV forums. And what we would do, especially with the neighborhood forums, the questions that we would ask of the candidates, what will you do when you get in office? And then
yeah.
we have someone to follow those meetings. It never got off the ground as good as we would have liked it to. But the idea was for someone to rotate and go to every council meeting, every county commission meeting, to
yeah.
follow through to see if, in fact, they were going to do what they said they were going to do. If not, we'd call a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Of that,
of the elected official,
to see
and confront.
Where are we on this?
Okay.
You know,
find that was effective?
Well, like I said, we didn't get into it. Like, it didn't bloom out to what we anticipated because with volunteers, you can't always. It worked in some cases when there were really hot issues on the table. But to get someone just to go to those meetings a lot of times is boring unless you're actively working on whatever. Issue it is, you know.
Right.
I'm dying. Are you okay? Are you comfortable?
I'm all right. Do you want to get a glass of water?
I might get something.
Yeah.
So, let's see. That's there.
Is this voter coalition still active?
It is. We just met Saturday.
Okay.
It's not in the form, it's not currently in the form that it was even last year. For various and sundry reasons, mostly with, for a coalition to have lasted since 1984 is unusual.
Okay.
You know, a coalition is comes together for a certain issue and then they disband. And we came together and stayed together basically because I'm living here and I had some other people who were real interested in keeping it together.
Mm-hmm.
But I told you the 35 counties that we worked in, a lot of that disbanded because they didn't have the same people who were trained in the outset. They didn't pass it along, so you got different forms of voter participation along the way.
So it was a statewide organization?
Yeah, it was a North Carolinians for Effective
Citizens.
Oh, okay.
Was the statewide.
Right.
And then the Mecklenburg Voter Coalition
was
the local
one
arm.
Of the counties, right.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
That was exactly right.
So. Yeah. Yeah, you mentioned, because you had on the phone, had the stability of the presence, that's why you thought the MVC stayed longer than some of the
that's
others.
That's what I think it happened. But you know, because all kinds of things happen. A lot of, we weren't nonpartisan, but we acted in a nonpartisan manner because a lot of the organizations that belonged to the coalition were nonpartisan. What is this?
Oh. What, were you Democrat? Was that your affiliation?
My affiliation was Democrat.
Yeah. I'm interviewing on Friday Margie Worthy.
Yeah. Margie worked with us a good while, but her predecessor was the one who started with us. His name was James Lawrence.
Okay.
Jim Lawrence.
I've heard that name somewhere.
Yeah, he was the original A. Philip Randolph person.
Okay.
And, yeah, we had a very, very good relationship with him. And, you know what I found?
Well, thanks for taking the time to find all this. This is
I just grabbed
really
this stuff.
Good,
this
so.
Is interesting. This is. I found that I didn't even. I had no idea where
oh,
it was.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's where I got a lot of my campaign training. Murray Fisher was like the guru in political campaigns.
Huh.
And so I did my advanced organizing with Midwest Academy out of Chicago.
Oh, I've heard of that.
You've heard of them?
Yeah.
Okay, so the local, I mean, when the first basic organizer training came with Kathy and Cy Conn.
Okay.
Here. And
yeah.
then the advanced with Midwest Academy. Then Murray Fisher. This is a master's level program.
Okay. Yeah.
That he did. And
so you've really worked with the top people, it sounds like, or some of the top people, community
yes,
organizing and
uh-huh.
so forth.
Oh, I've met some wonderful people along the way. I'm just kind of summing this in this meeting. That was another Democratic Party award. We just helped to
mm-hmm.
get him. I don't know if you know the story about Andrew Reyes, you know,
yeah.
first Latino or Hispanic chair of the party.
Oh, great.
He was great while he was in. Got into a little trouble.
Oh. Okay.
After that, let's see. The stuff I wrote, I didn't sign it. I got it on my computer somewhere.
Yeah.
But it's talking to what the role of the churches and nonprofits, what they can do.
Oh,
the role
yeah.
they can play and get out the vote.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. But I even found stuff that got wet. Huh?
Would it be possible to have a copy of that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, good.
Yeah. All right, I'm just going to get some water now, and I'll be right back.
Okay, great.
You know, it finally dawned on me. Let's see, okay. Now the other, I'm going to make sure I got, where's the other sheet?
Oh, the life history
form? Together, yeah.
This one? Okay.
And put that together.
Okay, great.
And, you know, I said the reason why I almost cried because this clip has been on here with, it's rusted. It's been in there so long.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when you're so busy with other things, you probably don't have a whole lot of time.
This is
to
old.
This
is really old, too. So, actually, the Institute was one of the last organizations that he and I created.
What was it called?
The Institute for Community Resources and Public
Policy. Well, you've been involved in lots of organizations, so.
So then it's documented here what I had done as far as.
Oh,
so
yeah.
that's helpful, I hope, too.
Yeah.
Maybe we can make a copy of this, because I think
yeah.
this might be the only one I have.
That
left.
Would be good,
know.
Yeah.
And then right. also, it tells what the organization did, and what it provided, the skills it provided. Then it has what others say.
Okay.
And then it talks, I mean, specifically mentions me and Ron in a couple places
yeah.
where we did work in other counties.
Yeah, anything
so
of this, you know, that I can make copies of is helpful, because...
Okay.
Just to have that sort of documentation is good, and it's in the Southern Historical Collection, which is considered the top collection in the world of materials related to the U.S. South,
oh.
right at UNC Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And then I'll you know, be sure to send you a copy of the tape and the transcripts and so forth.
Okay.
So
great.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, really, has anyone ever done an oral history of you before?
No.
Oh, okay.
So I am really honored, and I didn't know quite what to expect.
Yeah, it's going to be a little different because, but I've done short oral histories before. But basically is, if you say words I don't know how to spell, we'll have to save a little time at the end,
okay.
And I'll just jot them down so I have it right for the historical record. Mm-hmm. And then there's interview agreement that we both should be happy with the oral history at the end. We'll just sign this, so legal form. And it's just basically like a conversation and
okay,
and
well,
just,
I can do that.
Yeah, just like we talked, you know, we're talking on the phone, just kind of asking some, you know, general questions, but specific ones too about your community organizing, particularly interested in the 70s and 80s work. And so forth. So, and you know, anytime you want to stop or if you don't, I mean, sometimes people, they'll start saying something and they won't feel comfortable then with what maybe they're going to reveal. I had that earlier today. He was like, stop the tape. And then he told me some insider stuff that was intriguing, but I won't reveal it. So why don't we, this is great because this gives me, some sort of, you know, background information too for knowing how to target the questions. You said on the phone that you came out of the civil rights movement in Durham.
Yes, that's how, well, that's almost the way my activism started. I'd like to go further back to that, if I may.
Sure, because part of the process of doing oral histories is like both of us shape it, and I have questions, but they might not be exactly the areas you want to talk about. So, and since especially we have limited time, we should just focus on the major things. So, and from time to time, I'm just going to be checking to make sure it's picking up. Anyway, all right, that said, go ahead. Yeah, tell me about the beginning of your activism.
I just wanted to establish the mindset, why.
Yeah, exactly.
I got into it. And that comes from family, okay? My grandfather, who was a plastering contractor in Mecklenburg County, and he worked in all up and down the East Coast, and some of his most notable work as a plasterer was in Washington on a lot of the government buildings there, the last one being the archives.
The National Archives
in Washington was the last big piece that he did. But he and some other men in the neighborhood in North Mecklenburg, up in the Huntersville area, back then those were times of segregation, and it was during World War II. And so the black neighborhood was not incorporated into the town of Huntersville, nor was it in Charlotte. It was like a mile outside of the Huntersville town limit. So it was this town called Pottstown, and it was like a little village. And it did not have water piped in. A lot of people went to a spring to get their water for washing, for drinking, for everything. It did not have lights. It didn't have paved streets. So a group of men in the neighborhood got together and said to the town of Huntersville if they could tap on to the water system, you know, would they help them out? And so Huntersville said, yeah, but you're going to have to find your own pipe. Because this was when resources were very, very slim during the war. So they took up the challenge. And they found pipe. It was not to regulation or to specification, if you will. And they dug the ditches and put the pipe in, crossed their fingers and prayed that water would come through. And the town turned it on and the water gushed out. And they had water for everyone in that neighborhood. And they went on from there to establish street lights. Huh. And to get the streets paved. And so these were the oral histories that were passed down. So this was before my time. I was born in 1949. So this was just prior to that. And of course, as a baby, I wouldn't know what had gone on. But they told me these stories. And my grandfather was always one to not just settle with the way things are, if he could help make some improvements in his life as well as in his neighbors' lives as well.
What was his name?
Alexander Edward Henderson. And my mother sort of took up that banner too, when she and the other community leaders would come together to do, they had a community association and they worked on various issues together. The one thing that my mom did was voter registration. That's how I got involved in it in the outset. She used to do that. And so, you know, things that your parents do that kind of fall by the wayside, you know, when you go off to college and you grow, you think you've grown anyway, and you're off to live your own life.
Yeah.
So I was an academic by this time, and I'm in college, and the civil rights movement really hit in a lot of areas. In Charlotte, it was not the same as it was, say, in Greensboro and Durham and Wilmington. I think that in those other areas, they were a lot more aggressive than in Charlotte. Charlotte was very, very polite, but there was an undercurrent going on. With my, let me go back just a minute here. Just prior to busing, just prior to the official desegregation, okay, my class, my brother's class, I was in ninth and eighth grade, 1965. We were the first experimental desegregation class. It did not come by force busing. And so I was at Torrance Lytle, which was a union school, 1st through 12th. And so we could volunteer to go to North Mecklenburg, which was a predominantly white school, a mile away.
So you grew up in Charlotte?
I grew up in Huntersville.
In Huntersville, okay.
And I took my music lessons and everything else that I did, extracurricular, I did in Charlotte, the honors band and everything else, but I went to school and was raised up in the Huntersville area.
Okay.
It's all Mecklenburg County, though.
Okay.
And it was very interesting because by desegregation not being the rule, we were able to go into North Mecklenburg with over 300 African-American students. Whereas at East Mecklenburg, at the very same time, there was only one African-American man. Then busing occurred, and then it was spread out.
Yeah.
Okay. Very interesting concept, because when we went in, this was an amusing story in a way. We were livid behind it, though. North Mecklenburg, you know, every school has a yearbook and a mascot.
Yeah.
Okay, before we went to North Mecklenburg, their mascot was the Viking, their yearbook was the Rebel. And if anyone knows anything about North Mecklenburg, its mascot right now is the Viking, okay? But when we got there, they switched it around. They made the Rebel the mascot and the yearbook the Rebel. So do you know how that made us feel going in? We burned the Rebel in effigy.
Yeah.
We were quite upset behind that.
Yeah.
But there was a little group of us who were considered leaders of our class. We went to the principal and said we were willing to sit down and talk and work things out. There were no African-American cheerleaders. There were no African-American queens or in the court even for homecoming. There were not... majorettes, no African-American majorettes, no one for the, you've heard of the Carousel Princess? Have you heard about that? Well, then that person, yes, she's like a princess that represents the county, and she may or may not go on to some other, I don't know whether it's Miss North Carolina or whatever, but anyway, she represents Mecklenburg County, rising Christmas parade.
Right? Okay.
So they come from the high schools, and I suppose they do this in every county. Another girl and myself ran for Miss Carousel Princess. And we were right at the top. One of us should have won. I mean, it was like two here and the rest fell a long ways away in terms of talent and the questions that were asked of us. But neither one of us were chosen. It was a Caucasian female that was chosen. And that's just the way things were at that time. Now, we continued to go to the principal's office to meet about all these inequities. And we said we were really willing to sit down and talk, whereas our brothers and sisters from Alexander Junior High, once they got to North Mecklenburg, they would not sit down. They would act rather than talk. So my senior year in 1968, I ran off to Durham.
So the ones that came, you said in terms of act rather than talk, they would protest or, okay.
Really protest, yeah.
You tried to negotiate.
We tried to negotiate.
Yeah.
Right. And so we didn't know if that was going to come to fruition or not, but sure enough, my sophomore year at Central, I went on spring break to New York and I was flying back. And the person that was sitting in the seat next to me on the plane asked, you know, well, did we have very many problems with desegregation? We had empowerment rise. I said, oh no. You know, it wasn't too bad so far. I'm from Charlotte. I got back and I looked in the paper and all hell had broken loose in Charlotte. They were rioting at North Mecklenburg as well as some of the other places too.
Wow.
Because of those very same things that we had brought up before.
And you didn't end up, they didn't give in much to your demands?
A few things were changed, but not across the board.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, full participation for all students.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
The other thing that happened that you run into, for instance, I had a Caucasian friend who was in the band with me. He wanted my brother and myself to play in this jazz band with him. And we were walking down the hall talking about what we were going to do. And this woman who was, I guess, with the business education, she was in the secretarial pool or something like that, she looked out and saw us walking down the hall and she told the principal we were walking down the hall holding hands. And we were not.
Mm.
We were not. It was a very constructive conversation. Of course, he got upset, the student got upset about it. He says, well, let's just give him something to talk about. And we did a lot of planning together. We actually held hands. We weren't going together or anything like that. But do you know the Klan actually called the principal?
I was going to say.
So we better break that up or else they were going to do I don't know what all.
And
see, I never realized that it was that kind of contention going on before high school. Because when I was a little girl, my mother never told us the difference because she didn't want us to have any less confidence or self-esteem than anybody else. She didn't say we couldn't sit at the lunch counters. She'd say, we're going to eat somewhere else today rather than tell us the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple times she let us sit there and the clerk would actually give us a hot dog or whatever on their own.
Interesting.
At the Five and Dime store.
Yeah.
And then at Sears, there was the water fountains that were different. You had the colored water fountain white, colored and white. And my mother never told us that we couldn't drink out of either fountain. So mm-hmm. we just did. And we wanted to know, we went to the colored fountain really excited because we wanted to know what colored water tasted like. We thought it was like, you know, uh-huh. colors, you know,
yeah.
and maybe the taste was vivid, like colors. And so we thought, you know. So she never told us those differences. And it hit pretty hard by the time we got to high school. You know, Martin Luther King died, you know, Kennedy was assassinated, you know, Robert Kennedy. All that just jolted us. You know, this is around last junior high school. We were brought into the real world at that point. The other thing, along with that guy asking me, you know, what was happening in my town regarding were we rioting or whatever. The other thing I noticed, when I got off that plane, I caught a cab back to campus. And I was going by, the cab had to pass by the student union on the way to my dorm. And I saw this fellow sliding down off the side of what had been leaning on the wall and was sliding down. And I didn't know what it was. I was totally naive. And I found out later that he was high on heroin.
Mm.
Heroin had been introduced to the African American community and it just blew up. It was just like all of a sudden. It was no way in the world that they imposed that on themselves. It was brought from outside.
Mm.
That's how, you know, I've seen some other commentaries who indicate that might have been, you know, what happened too, but it's just, I mean, it was just all of a sudden, unless I was just so naive I didn't see it coming. You know, you think about musicians or whatever, you know, they talk about it. But it was not pervasive at all. It was just boom, it was there.
With the late 60s, early 70s, mm-hmm. Interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Moving right along, I think I was telling you earlier that we didn't have the internships and practicums that we've had, that most students have nowadays. We had to work for students coming behind us to have those opportunities, mm-hmm. those work and experience type opportunities. But we had our sororities and fraternities. In particular, Delta Sigma Theta was my sorority, and that was the major reason I pledged for public, to gain public service. Okay, this was right in the middle of the riots in Durham, also. So I got to work at a halfway house. I got to work for a breakfast program where you had inner city kids starving right here in the United States. I marched in downtown Durham protesting with bricks being thrown and glass flying, and we were just sort of oblivious to all that. We still didn't understand the whole ramifications. We didn't understand what all was going on, but we knew that we were trying to fight for something better, to be able to participate something better in our lives. You know, people should not be separated like that, and we should be able to engage in the same activities regardless of race. Race is just there's no real definition for it, to tell you the truth. When you bring it right down to it, there is not. So we just did not understand it. We were ready to fight for whatever we had to do. But I was in a lot of danger, but we and the rest of the people that were along with us, but we didn't have any idea of the real magnitude of it.
Were you ever injured, or anyone you were with ever injured?
There were some people that were injured. I can't even remember their names now. I don't remember any deaths per se, but we were in precarious situations there for sure.
What gave you the strength to, you know?
The group. And then people, you know, this was also the beginning of the Black Power movement.
Do you consider yourself part of the Black Pippin?
No, not really.
Okay.
I was part of the establishment, more or less, and the Black Power. And then we all tried to conform. I mean, that was hilarious, some of the things that we did. But.
So the civil rights marches and so forth you participated in, was this part, like, associated with an organization? Were you, like, was the sorority more like public service, or was
the sorority was public service, but it was so much more than the sorority.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I don't really know who all the leadership groups were at that time, but you know, it was like a call to action, and we all came together. And you could get students to do that before you could a lot of people in the communities even.
Yeah.
You know.
I know, like Howard Fuller was like a major activist.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So there were always speeches and stuff going on. This action is taking place here. That action is taking place there, and everybody just went.
Okay.
So that's what I'm saying. We were really oblivious to some of the real results of what was going on too. You know.
What do you mean by that?
But we didn't know what it was really going to result in.
Okay.
We knew a little bit about it, but not that it would actually change any laws or change anyone's perspective to the degree that it did. Now, I still feel like we're going through it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there have been a lot of changes.
So what time period were you doing these marches in college? When were you in college?
That was between six, it was around 70 something, 70, 70. 1,
okay.
Something like that.
Sure.
6871, something like that.
Yeah. What, so you said you still see the struggle is ongoing. What do you think it accomplished, and what do you think there still is to accomplish?
Okay, well, the laws changed so that we can go to restaurants and to hotels. We can buy homes in whatever area, although I understand there's an undercurrent there even in some cases where African Americans are not encouraged to move into a certain area. The amount for the home or whatever is so high. It's like an economic thing now, but then when it boils down to it, it's people don't want others in the neighborhood. I think it's just taken on a different look now, and I think it's not as overt as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, they won't speak out and let their real feelings be known.
Okay.
I currently go to a mixed church. That's one of the last bastions of segregation as far as I'm concerned.
Churches? Yeah. I know.
Church,
about
funeral homes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're getting around to cremation now, so that part doesn't make any difference, but that those are still places where you see a lot of segregation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So would you say that this participation in this kind of awakening to civil rights issues when you were in college and your work with the sorority is what inspired you to end up making this, what sounds like to me like a whole career of community organizing and so forth?
But it was activism then.
Okay.
There is a distinction.
Yeah, okay.
It was just total, straight out activism because it was the right thing to do, I felt like. But I'm still pursuing a degree so that I can get out there in the day-to-day work world, all right? And I felt like I separated the two.
Okay, yeah.
All right. Yeah. But what essentially happened when I went in, okay, I was planning to do some type of social work, social service work. Okay. When I went in, the doors were wide open. Went into college.
Okay.
Should sit there. When I came out, Nixon had just been elected. I was trying to go to work with NIH.
National Institute of Health? Okay.
All the social service type programs were shut down.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. I ended up working in the Department of Labor for a while. That's all a personal history, how I ended up in D.C.
Oh. Okay.
But it was like I applied for about 15 different jobs in the Charlotte area, and being young and impatient, I waited maybe 30 days, if that, before I took off to Washington.
D.C. is a good place to be. Yeah.
With cousins and whatnot. So I worked for the Department of Labor for a very short while.
Okay.
And I almost got a second degree in early childhood education. So I started working on issues of children during that time frame. And I just didn't, you know. There were publicly funded programs, both in Washington and in Maryland, the state of Maryland. I was married to a Washington policeman. And I do feel like that my life, the way my life has gone, I've actually been able to experience a lot of the issues that people are going through. And I think that was intentional by God or whomever, so that I like to talk. So it's to be an advocate, to work with people. You've got to feel issues in your gut before you can really work to do anything about them. And I really feel it. But that's what's happened with me. At 27 years old, I became a widow. My husband was a policeman who was killed in the line of duty, and he was in vice and narcotics.
Wow.
Okay? So, and he even took me around to see some of the neighborhoods that he had worked in and everything. And it was like I wanted to gather all the children up, put them on a truck, and take them somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the experiences that they received in Washington. So I was a widow at 27, feeling a little bad, feeling by myself. But this was also during the time of the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of young widows out there. You know, so had to buck up and go on. I moved home, had a 2-year-old son, moved home, with the hopes of growing up with Charlotte. And that's exactly what happened.
I moved. Being here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I moved home in 77, into 76.
Okay.
Moved home.
Yeah.
After he was killed, I went to UNC to do graduate work over there. And I was doing a degree in urban administration, which is the same thing as public administration.
UNC Charlotte?
And rode past what was called Carolina Community Project over on 7th Street.
Okay.
And I was wondering, what in the world is that Carolina Community Project, man? I mean, it really intrigued me. And so I found out later from a friend that they were organizers. It was this house on the corner of 7th and Laurel. It's not there anymore. But the same, our landlord was the guy who built this 2-3-story building that's over there right now. And SciComm had a group called Grassroots Leadership, regional organizing outfit that provided technical assistance to existing organizations as well as helping to create others. So it was the regional. It was like the mothership, if you will. And they had an office in that same house. It was a blue house. So they operated on a regional level. And then Carolina Community Project was something they created as a statewide group of organizers. It was not membership based.
Okay.
But we worked with other membership based organizations and we helped to create others where voids existed. Okay. I came on to work for Carolina Community Project. My very first job was to help develop what came to be Mecklenburg Council of Senior Citizens.
Huh.
That was very, very interesting work. You haven't worked with anyone until you've worked with seniors. So energetic. And this was back during the time when Senator Claude Pepper was in office.
Okay.
And we developed this action. Well, we were trying. Well, first of all, we were celebrating the birthdays of Social Security, and we were trying to get the cost of living increase to continue. Okay.
Yeah.
We had one congressman in Charlotte and it was all in the 9th district. You know, it's 3 congressional offices now represented in Charlotte Mecklenburg. Back then, it was only one. And that was McMillan, and he had the 9th district. And so the seniors did this big action where we invited McMillan to come down. I was the organizer. And so they had very good questions ready to ask Mr. McMillan. And I was so proud of our group.
Yeah.
And we had this huge cake which represented the birthday of Social Security. And we had the cake had candles on it, but also it was lined with little tiny American flags. And this was hilarious. I lit the candles and I was bringing it down the hallway up to the podium to him to present to him. And the theme was cut the cake and not the cola, the cost of living increase.
Oh.
The hallway had a breeze going. The candles lit the little flags. The flags were on fire. I was so embarrassed. Yes, it was. And the seniors were having a ball. I was embarrassed, but you know, McMillan took it in stride. He was a good show about the whole thing. But that was one of my first organizing fiascos.
That's a good story. Yeah.
But then after that, we went to Washington. We went to Washington and took all these seniors from all over the country, met there, and they had jalopies and then all these buses and a parade around the country. And then we went to the various senators and congressional offices to talk about the seniors' issues. And, oh man, we had a ball. But we went from there, when the funding ran out from there, then they got, all of a sudden, all these private foundations were interested in voter participation. And that's when we formed North Carolinians for Effective Citizenship.
Wow.
And I went to that full time, but I'm still connected with Carolina Community Project. And then we had the AFL, the League of Women Voters, I mean, just about 15 different organizations that came together to do statewide voter participation. And we did it in about 35 counties that year. And so it was, the group was very strong up until the 90s when we had various senatorial campaigns going on. Harvey Gantz's senatorial campaign, both of them in 90 and in 92. His first mayoral campaigns, he won the first two and the last one, Sue Merritt won that one. And so we were instrumental. The main thing is we wanted to get people to participate. The group itself was not nonpartisan, but we operated in a nonpartisan manner because we had so many people, organizations that were nonpartisan. So our main interest was participation. Okay, so we worked for, you know, we had really high level contested campaigns all through that period. And of course it was Mel Watt, who's my boss, who was elected in 1992. So I actually came from campaign to come work in a congressional office. A lot of people don't understand that there is a difference though. Like if I go to work on a campaign now, I have to take leave from the congressional office to work. The congressional office is totally and purely service oriented and is paid for by taxpayers' money. Anyone who has an application or claim with a federal agency can come to us in the district and we'll help try to help them unravel it. Whereas if the DC office is mostly legislative in its work. Okay, you have legislative liaisons there.
Yeah.
And we're on the front line here in the district with the constituents, with their problems, with federal agencies. Then on campaign side, you know, we can actually pull out and go work that if we had, not everybody does, because some people are just strictly congressional. But with having a campaign experience, a lot of times I would go on leave for a few months to work campaign.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. I'm gonna turn it off a second.
The proceeding was
Elizabeth Ritter interviewing Tawana Wilson Allen at her office, Mel Watt's office, that's where she works right now, in Charlotte, North Carolina, on May 10, 2006.